Every story told has a story of its own.
If I wasn't in this room, what could I say to people so they understand how it feels to be in this room?
She said the words, "I won't forget it. What more do you want from me?"
It was on the fly decision making. It was drinking water from a fire hose at that point.
Bringing you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook. Now here's your host, Adam Roberts.
Welcome to Reporter's Notebook, where we take a deeper dive on the biggest stories of the past week as told from the perspective of the reporters and anchors telling you the news. I'm Adam Roberts. Thank you once again for joining me here today. As per usual, we have a lot of things to get to, and we're going to start with one of the bigger gets of this past week right here on WTMJ. You heard it on Wisconsin's Afternoon News. There are multiple sources telling our own John Mercure that Governor Tony Evers does not plan to seek a third term as governor of the state of Wisconsin. It brings to mind an interesting discussion on what goes into sourced reporting. You hear it a lot, whether it's TV, radio, in the paper. What does it mean to have your sources and how do you cultivate them? So for more on this, John has joined us here on Reporter's Notebook today. John, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, I love the show. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's talk about this idea of sourced reporting, because as I just said, you hear people say, sources tell me, da-da-da-da, and people have questions. Okay, who are your sources? How did you get these people? What goes into the process of gathering up that laundry list of people you can contact and say, can you tell me more about this? What do we know?
So sourced reporting is important reporting, but it can be dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're a journalist. You know that we have people all the time that are telling us things. I have people on a regular basis that tell me you should look at this or I'm hearing this. So when you decide to use a source, like on this story about Governor Evers' decision to not seek re-election, it's really about how much do you trust the individual source? There's a lot of vetting that goes into whether I use a source as something I'm officially going to report or whether I kind of hold it as background in the back of my head. And for me, I had one source that told me this several days ago. And my personal rule as a journalist has always been that unless I need two sources, mm-hmm. unless it's an unimpeachable source, like if it was Tony Evers himself. So otherwise, two sources. So I sat on the one source and I tried very hard to get somebody else to confirm what I was hearing. And it took a few days. And I think when you talk about sourced reporting, it's important. You hear it a lot in sports, like about contract terms and trades and that sort of thing. But you hear it in news quite a bit as well. It's an important part of what we do, but you have to be careful. I'd rather be right than be first. And there's a lot of pressure, Adam, you know, in what we do to be first, mm-hmm. to break a story, to send out the first tweet. But I'd rather be right than be first. So cultivating sources is a big part of getting at some of these bigger stories.
I mean, you mentioned the mantra we use all the time, it's better to be right than first.
Yep.
But on the other hand, we do also have a responsibility if we know something and we're confident and would bet our career on it being true, we do owe it, especially in the world of this kind of news, to get it out there so people know.
I think so, too. I mean, it's news. It's a story that everybody's talking about. And it's tough sometimes. There's a pressure to be first, but I think there's a greater pressure to make sure you're talking to the right people in the community, people that you trust, people that have helped in the past, people who have a proven track record. But let's face it, when you're using sources, there's always a gray area. Unless Governor Evers is telling me this himself, unless Dame Lillard says to me personally he's going to Portland, using a source is always a little bit of a risk. And in this case, Governor Evers could change his mind in the next 5 days and decide that he is running. My source could be wrong. But you do everything you can to vet those sources, and sources have track records too, and they have different levels of reliability. I have people tell me stuff all the time. Unless they're people that I've used, I'm very reluctant to give them any credibility or airtime.
We're going to have AJ Bhayatpur from CBS 58 on later in the show about a press club AMA he did, an Ask Me Anything, with local members of the public. And I'm going to ask him the same question I'm asking you now. How critical is it in the early part of your career, and you've been doing this quite a while, mm-hmm. to earn those local sources, those small town people who you can turn back to and say, hey, I need you on this because no one else in my newsroom knows you like I do?
It's critical and it's tough. It's hard when you're starting out to get sources that'll trust you. You come into a new organization or you come into a new town and you want desperately to have people in the police department that will help you out or people in City Hall that will help you out. It's hard. It's tough, but it's critical. It's what sets you apart. And the other thing is the sourcing feeds itself. So if you have really good sources that are telling you things, like in the police department, let's just use that example, other people in the police department begin to know that, hey, John Mercure or hey, WTMJ is willing to tell our story. They seem ethical. They seem like good guys. They seem to get it right. And then more sources come to you. So it's hard to get those sources, especially young in your career. But then they almost feed themselves. It's like you begin to hear from other sources. And your source may encourage somebody else to talk to you who's an expert in another area. So it's critical, but it's difficult. It just takes a lot of work. And then, Adam, it's taking care of the source all the time. I mean, I can't just expect a source in the Milwaukee Police Department, if they don't hear from me for months and months and months, to feed me stuff. I work at making sure that I reach out to those sources when nothing's going on. Hey, Lieutenant, how are things going? John Mercure, WTMJ, just thinking about you. Hope you have a great weekend, that sort of thing.
WTMJ's John Mercure really doing a good job peeling back the cover a little bit to see how the process works. Thanks so much, John.
Hey, thank you, Adam.
Sticking with the world of Wisconsin politics, there was a big story that broke technically last year, but has carried forth for several months on and off in the city of Madison, and it could have ramifications for the election process in our state in election cycles going forward. You've likely heard the story by now of the 193 uncounted absentee ballots that were left in courier bags in the city during the November 2024 election. That led to a Wisconsin Elections Commission investigation into the situation targeted at the practices of City Clerk Maribeth Witzel Bell, who has since resigned from her position. This past week, the commission met once again to approve the findings of that investigation, which included the note that Witzel Bell, in their eyes, had probable cause to the fact that she broke five election laws.
The buck didn't stop anywhere. The lack of curiosity, the testimony that, you know, oh, there might have been ballots there, but I didn't ask for a full month, was not plausible.
Now, where do things go from here, and what are the ramifications for the election cycle across the state, as well as best practices? For more on this, we're joined by trending political reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Hope Carnop. Hope, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
So let's begin by getting some context for how we got to this point, because as I mentioned, this process dates back to November of last year and has kind of gone on again, off again in the news cycle whenever WEC, the Elections Commission, has new information or reportings to find. So what's the latest we know?
Right. Yeah, that's totally right. The latest thing that has happened was WEC has released the findings of its investigation, which took about 6 months. I believe they approved it back in January. So It's taken a long time for them to piece together their findings from reviewing records and conducting depositions with city and county staff. So what has happened this week was the commission met to approve the findings in that report and consider the next steps. And this, you know, goes back several months, all the way back to December when it was first revealed that there were uncounted ballots. And at the time, WEC had said that they really weren't aware, despite the fact that Madison knew a couple weeks beforehand. So it's been a continuing saga, and this is the latest step in that.
One of the things that came up during the investigations process was this idea that while no charges will be formally presented from the commission because they don't have the authority to do so, they do believe there's probable cause that illicit activities happened under the watch of the city clerk. Now, the DA's office would ultimately have the authority. If they were to refer charges, they would be the ones to do so. Do we know if that's likely to be the case at all? Are we hearing from the DA's office on this matter?
It doesn't seem likely at this point. When the commission met this week, they discussed the possibility of, you know, whether charges could be recommended to the DA or another law enforcement agency in Wisconsin. And really the concerns from the commissioners and also the Dane County clerk who testified said that this would really be counterproductive because they don't want to criminalize clerks in Wisconsin. obviously this was a glaring error and something that people, you know, on the commission acknowledged that was really grave and serious. But I think the problem that commissioners brought up is that if clerks were to make smaller errors in the future, that they would not want to fear, you know, prosecution, and that clerks are already operating under scrutiny and have, you know, brought up issues with threats to their safety in the past. So as of right now, it doesn't look like any criminal charges will be brought. And I think that is partly to set a precedent that clerks, you know, will not be prosecuted in the state of Wisconsin in the future.
Trending political reporter Hope Carnop with us on Reporter's Notebook today on this Madison ballot investigation situation. You talk about precedent, Hope. Are we hearing from other municipalities across Wisconsin that have observed this from an outsider's perspective and are seeing what the recommendations are being made from WEC and changing their own practices to avoid a similar situation?
Sure. Yeah, that's certainly the hope from commissioners, is to put out the findings of this report and encourage clerks to review their own practices for any potential pitfalls and avoid those in future elections. I will note that the commission, before the April Supreme Court election, did send out guidance to clerks with best practices for handling and tracking absentee ballots. So I think clerks were at that point encouraged to review them, knowing that this had gone on in Madison. The other thing to keep in mind is that the commission may order specific procedures in Madison to prevent something like this from happening in the future. And at the meeting, they talked about whether to recommend those to clerks across the state instead of just Madison. So it's definitely going to be, you know, on clerks' mind to review their procedures for tracking absentee ballots and making sure that those are strong for future elections.
Hope, before we let you go today, outside of the Madison ballot investigation, are there other stories trending in the political universe for our state in what is an off year? Obviously, it's never really off in the world of politics. There's a lot going on. What should we be keeping our eye on?
The biggest storyline that we're tracking is the governor's race, and that's changing, you know, day to day. And then there's the Republican side, of course. There's a couple candidates who have put their name in, still waiting to hear from potential contenders like Congressman Tom Tiffany. So governor's race will definitely be heating up. Now that the state budget is over, we'll continue to track the impacts of that, as well as any legislation that will be introduced in the state capitol in the coming weeks.
Trending political reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Hope Carnop, with great stuff. Thanks so much, Hope.
Thank you.
Tragic story unfolded this past week out of the city of Sheboygan at the JC Quarry. This is on the north and western edge of the city, where a 13-year-old boy was swimming in the quarry with friends, then went under the water and never resurfaced early in the week. A search ensued over the course of many days, and ultimately the fire chief sharing the unfortunate news.
Approximately 12 o'clock, we were able to locate the individual, the 13-year-old male. Family members were able to confirm it was their child.
WTMJ's Julia Fellow was at the scene at the quarry this past week. Julia, walk me through when you arrived. What did the scene look like? What was the response? This was not just the city of Sheboygan situation.
I know. There's a lot of people that were across the street. So this is right on Calumet Drive near North Avenue. And this one, when I just parked, this one couple was just there listening to the police scanner, because it shows how tight-knit the city of Sheboygan is. They just wanted to show support to the rescuers and the family that was desperately trying to get any type of answers. By the time I got there, it was the next day, the next morning at about noon, and we knew that this was now a recovery effort for a 13-year-old who was jumping off of the rocks. There's one part of this quarry, Lake Park, that is shallow. And there, you know what this is.
Right. So for context, I have swam in this quarry many times. This is very close to where my mother and my grandmother live in Sheboygan. And before they moved there, even, we would go swim at this quarry multiple times. And it is very varied, as a lot of quarries are, in where the shallow areas are, where the swimming is supposed to happen, and where the deeper areas are, where young teenagers will tend to, legal or otherwise, go swimming.
There's no swimming restricted area on that side. And that's so funny that you say that, Adam, because when I walked up, it looked like there it was like a water park on this lake, because that's the shallow part of it. So the other part is 30 to 45 feet deep. And that's where the 13-year-old apparently jumped off. They don't know if he dived off, jumped off, but he was in trouble. The kids with him tried to rescue him, but he went under. What's really interesting is the Sheboygan City Fire Chief said they got on scene within 3 minutes, but it was still too late. So divers went down, and I saw them in all of their rescue gear, and it was a hot, humid day. They were taking turns. It was 87 degrees once they discovered his body. And the reason why is because on that side there's crevices, because this is once a quarry. And there's equipment. There's also fishing wires, fishing poles, muck. So there was very low visibility, and these divers were just really feeling for what was going on. They're using sonar. And I heard over the scanner that they got something. They took all of the divers back. And then I was a little bit further away from Calumet Drive from where all of the photographers were. I was under a tree, and I heard a guttural scream that is unmistakable. And it was the mother identifying the body, because next of kin has to identify. Then I saw the mother walking out, and she was just screaming, waving her hands, saying, "My son, my son." Other family members were there. I mean, there was police, that was an ambulance going in. You know, you could tell that, you could tell what happened, that the body was found. And then there was family. They looked like they were going to throw up, some shaking their heads, bawling. Some looked like they were going to faint, holding onto their knees and hunched over. I mean, this is a huge loss. I mean, this is a 13-year-old boy, and you could see it on the faces of all the rescuers that this really, really was unnecessary, shouldn't have happened. And that was just an area where you shouldn't swim. And he was not a good swimmer.
Before I let you go, Julia, we mentioned at the beginning the magnitude of the response. You brought up the fact that Sheboygan Fire was there within 3 minutes of receiving that call. But there were more jurisdictions that responded to this scene as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Counties from all over the place. All the way up in Brown County, they came down. Dive rescue teams from Milwaukee County. I mean, this really shows how Southeast Wisconsin and in the Fox Valley and Northern, in the Green Bay area, like how tight-knit we are. Because in order to find this child, they needed really, really high-end sonar equipment because of how difficult this terrain is. And it was just so hot. I can't tell you. Even when I was just sitting under the tree for, like, you know, maybe 15 minutes before I heard that guttural scream from the mom. And I thought it was hot. So you think about all of the gear that you have to have on, and the people that are on the boat with no cover. They were just on the boat and they were searching, and they got to it. They got to it in the nick of time too, because I saw the dark clouds coming, and that's about when they found the body. And they were saying, even the fire chief was saying, and the rescue divers were saying, we're trying to go against the clock because there's going to be this huge torrential storm. And then we had a tornado warning that even took place in neighboring Fond du Lac County. So they got to it just in time. They said they're glad they're giving the family closure. They wouldn't release the name of the boy at the time of this recording.
WTMJ's Julia Fellow, good insight. Thanks so much. Wanted to bring you an update on a story we brought to you last month here on the show out of Southwest Wisconsin. You may recall us talking about the Black Hawk Bridge, which links communities in that region of the state with Lansing, Iowa, on the other side of the Mississippi River. Recall that bridge has undergone a lot of various construction projects over the years, which has caused a bit of a pain for people trying to get to and from either side of the river. Well, we have an update, and it might just be making the pain a little bit more severe for commuters and residents. And for an update on this now, we welcome back to Reporter's Notebook for the second time, health and environmental reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Madeline Heim. Madeline, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
All right. So before we get into the latest developments, let's recap the story of the bridge to this point that you've been covering for those who aren't familiar.
So the Lansing Bridge, that's its kind of common name, official name, the Black Hawk Bridge, which you said connects Lansing, Iowa with Crawford County in Wisconsin, is this iconic historic bridge in the region. It was built in 1931. So with it, you know, being constructed nearly 100 years ago, it is deteriorating. It's getting old. The steel parts, you know, have been having issues. And it also, interestingly, it stretches over one of the very tightest turns on the whole Mississippi River, and it makes it very difficult for barges to get through and make that turn. And there have been collisions in the past. So with all of that in mind, and especially the age, Iowa Department of Transportation officials and Wisconsin transportation officials started looking at, you know, can we construct a new bridge to replace this older one? And so we had construction start in late 2023 on a new bridge, which is just north of the old bridge. But as you mentioned, there have been some hiccups along the way. The bridge closed for 2 months last February when it moved slightly, so causing some safety issues. And it also closed for a few weeks this May and early June. And when they opened it up in June, they said that there was surely going to be another closure, you know, happening sometime later in the summer. And then here we have on July 14th, they announced that when they close the bridge in the fall, that is going to be closed for good. And then they're going to demolish the bridge completely.
So that is the most recent development in this story. And that means that for whether you're on either side, Wisconsin or Iowa, your main connection now between the two sides is gone. And that's a problem because, as we talked about last time, Madeline, there's an economic tail to this story as well.
Yeah. So when I talk to, you know, residents and businesses and tourism folks, the last time that the bridge was closed, they really emphasized to me that these communities on either side of the river are like one big community. They cross the river all the time. And it's just a real short drive when that bridge exists to shop and to visit, you know, friends and to go to restaurants, go to the doctor, the dentist on the other side of the river. And with that closed, you know, you're looking at either going down to Prairie du Chien or going up to La Crosse, which is adding, you know, 30 miles each way to make that crossing, unless you have your own boat to cross the river. So it will certainly affect these communities, turning what once was a very short, easy commute into something much longer.
You mentioned boats. We're talking with Madeline Heim, health and environmental reporter at the Journal Sentinel. You mentioned the boats. Last time we spoke, you brought up that there was an individual who sort of went into business for themselves, if you will, and created a literal barge to transport cars across the river as a way of saying, hey, you don't have to make that super long commute. I'll just take you across the water. Is that going to continue now that we know that the closure will begin sooner than was previously thought?
So, yeah, so it wasn't a barge. It was someone who was taking, it was kind of like a water taxi. So sure. Your car couldn't go on it, but you could hop on one side of the river and be dropped off on the other side of the river. Iowa transportation officials did say that they are looking at bringing that back. I know that community members and, you know, business owners are hoping that in addition to that, there also might be a car ferry set up to help people, you know, make the journey and they don't have to do it with their own cars. Especially thinking about how, you know, if it closes this fall or when it closes this fall, I should say, we're headed into winter. The river does occasionally completely freeze over in that area. And so that will make it, you know, either very difficult or impossible for a boat to make that journey. So there's going to have to be some other way. And Iowa transportation officials are looking into different ways they can help kind of ease that burden for people.
Madeline, before I let you go, when it comes to officials with the DOT, what are they saying to sort of ease concerns of residents, if you will, about the longevity of this closure, which we're expecting now to be for at least the next couple of years?
Yeah. You know, it's going to be a long haul without the bridge. They were initially hoping to keep it open until right before the new bridge was set to open, which is still set for 2027. So now this will be, you know, at least a year, if not more, without a bridge in that area. But the thing that they have shared is, you know, this is really a safety issue, that the bridge is safe to cross right now. But because of the construction activities that they will need to keep doing on the new bridge, it's just not going to be safe to cross once they start, you know, working on those certain things. And that, you know, although this is going to be painful, certainly for those communities, it's better than, you know, a major safety hazard. And so it sounds like they're working, Wisconsin transportation officials as well, working on trying to find a solution. And, you know, I talked with a business owner yesterday, and she said that she's really hopeful that these communities will still stick together, will shop local on their side of the river once the bridge closes again. And she thinks that they'll be able to get through this.
Health and environmental reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Madeline Heim, closely following this story in southwest Wisconsin. Madeline, thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you ever wander out into your community and you see reporters, whether they're with television or radio or otherwise, standing out in the field doing a report live and in person, you've probably had several questions about the process that run through your head. Well, what if I told you there was a chance recently to flip the script a bit on the interviewers, usually, who then became the interviewees? Well, that did happen this past week at the Milwaukee Press Club, where four members of the journalism community in Milwaukee were basically the ones being asked the questions. And it brings up a lot of interesting dynamics when you flip that script. So I'm happy to be joined today by reporter for CBS 58, AJ Bayatpour, who was on that panel of four reporters. AJ, welcome in.
Adam, thanks for having me. Glad to do it.
Yeah, I was at the event. I first of all, I'm happy it was a free event, because that definitely was like, hey, I got to go and check this out. But I'm also a news nerd, and so I'm always curious about the process. What was the inclination for you to want to join this panel? What inspired you to want to be one of the four?
Well, I am a member of the Milwaukee Press Club board, and it was something that had come up something that I wanted to do. Tom Dakin from the Journal Sentinel, also a member of the Press Club board, had really helped spearhead this whole thing and had reached out and was asking around, seeing who would be willing to do this. And, you know, certainly I'm a fan of being able to make local journalism a little bit more tangible and accessible for people, so they can get a chance to not only see how it works, but get a better sense of the people doing it. And I felt like that sort of gathering was a great opportunity to do that, to be out there, talk a little bit about what we do, who we are, why we do it, and, you know, perhaps dispel some myths about media along the way. But, you know, mainly it was just being out there in a different setting. You know, you mentioned in the intro the idea of sometimes you see somebody out on the street reporting. This was an opportunity to see reporters not working necessarily, but kind of in person. We were approachable. You can come talk to us before or after that panel event, and certainly listening to us during it. I thought that was a unique opportunity and certainly something I hope we do some more.
You mentioned some of the myths that you hope to dispel. Was there a question that came up at any point, or is there one that you get outside of that panel that you always go, man, I wish that we could just really get this message that that's not the way it works?
Yeah, I think one question that stood out, there was a gentleman who had said something to the effect of he works with people in the justice field and believes, you know, he and others get misquoted 95% mm-hmm. of the time. I don't know what this individual's experiences are. And Todd Rosiak did a good job of kind of, you know, taking that question. But I can say for myself, I'm not misquoting people. You know, it's recorded. It's all there. It's on tape. And I think that, you know, the myth, to broaden that out, is that people tend to think that, well, you know, when I talk on the TV news or in some sort of broadcast medium, they're going to stitch together different things that I said to completely change the meaning. I personally have not seen that happen in a newsroom that I'm in. I can say that I've never done something like that. I haven't taken splices of what somebody said in an interview and then restructured, you know, what they're saying from different answers to create a whole different answer out of whole cloth to fit what I'm trying to say. What we'll do is we'll cut things down for time,
sure,
and for brevity. But I think that that is something I've heard before, is people have this idea like, well, you're just going to stitch together different things I say so that it fits what you want. I have no interest in doing that. I mean, it's all there. If this was happening, people would be able to call newsrooms. News managers would be able to say, hey, what did you do? What exactly happened here? If someone calls a station and is mad because they feel like they were misquoted, a news director is going to take that very seriously, and they're going to want to see the raw of that recording, and they're going to want to see, okay, what went on TV or radio and what was actually said in this interview. And if people are out here just completely making stuff up essentially, because that's what that would be, right? That would be essentially making stuff up. If you took three different answers and stitched them together for something completely different, news directors would see that. They would crack down on it, and people like that would not be long for this industry.
We're talking with reporter from CBS 58, AJ Biotpour. The idea that AI will have a presence in our newsroom was brought up, and what that looks like when used responsibly. Have you used AI when it comes to helping your workflow at all? Because I know that I have used programs like Headliner is one I use a lot for transcribing those recordings you talked about. It's not reducing the work. You still have to go and find quotes and gather the audio, but it does make the process a lot more streamlined. Do you do similar things?
I'm extremely old school. I had access to the Otter program that came up at that event, which also does that, the transcribing. So you could take a 15-minute interview clip and just transcribe it. And I've seen a lot of people who swear by it. It makes their life easier. I'm sure that it does. I'm very old school in the sense that I like to just listen to the raw interview and transcribe the parts that I find to be, you know, worth kind of setting aside and saying that might make it into the story. But, you know, I'd mentioned in that conversation the idea of AI not going away. And I might as well have been talking to myself as I was the whole room, because I was basically, you know, coming to grips with that myself, that AI is not going away. You know, we're not going to put that thing back in the box. Personally, I haven't used it yet in my work, but I can't say that I never will. Because at some point you have to be willing to adjust. And if the world moves in a direction where AI is just so prevalent, you know, I and others in my shoes have to be willing to say, how can I use this to be productive? How can I use this for good? Because are we at a point where if I don't, I'm going to be left behind?
One of the things I noticed at the press club event was the mix of age in terms of people who were listening to the conversation. You had people who clearly have read Daniel Bice columns for several decades, as he was one of the panel members. And then there were other people who were fresh interns at the Journal Sentinel asking questions of the panel. When it comes to the younger generation of journalists, they're facing challenges that even I, 15 years ago when I started, couldn't have imagined. What do you see as the biggest hurdle of entry when it comes to someone who's just out of college and thinks, this is what I want to do, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes?
The biggest hurdle is you don't get paid.
Very valid.
The money's terrible when you first start in this profession. And the reality is, you know, to take the traditional path, you're either going to hope that you get fortunate and you're jumping on in a bigger city or market like Milwaukee right out of school. And there's challenges there where either it's a question of, you know, are you ready to be thrown into that fire? But then there's also the cost of living that's associated with living in a bigger place. You know, the traditional path is you start in a small town, and that's also tough for a younger person. Some people don't want to do that. I embraced that. I was fine with it. That was the path. I did 3 years in Champaign, Illinois.
I had 3 or 4 years in WMDC in Mayville, Wisconsin, and I wouldn't have changed anything about it because it was so integral in developing those practices from an early age of getting your rhythm down and learning what it takes at a base level to do what we do.
Absolutely. And I think when we talk about whether it's Mayville, Champaign, any place like that, you know, La Crosse, Eau Claire, these are where a lot of people are getting started after school. Speaking of from a TV perspective, where a lot of these markets are, it's also important that I think young journalists take pride in that. The people in those communities deserve good reporting. If I was speaking to a room full of 22-year-olds, I'd tell them you should be proud. You should consider it an honor that someone wants you to come report on what's happening in Eau Claire or La Crosse. It's more than just a proving ground. I think something that gets lost in these, you know, working in quote-unquote small markets is these are people. They deserve good journalism just as much as people in Milwaukee, Chicago, New York, or L.A. It's a great opportunity, though, to learn the craft because in that smaller setting, there are fewer players to get to know. It's easier to make sources. And that is the bread and butter of good journalism. You need to develop sources so people can tell you what's really happening, so you're not getting spun in all kinds of different directions, because there are people whose job it is to try to spin you one way or another so that the article is more favorable to the people they're working for. Well, you as a reporter, obviously, you're not working for them. You need to simply report the truth as you best understand it to be. And a great place to start doing that is in a smaller community where you can just understand the lay of the land a little bit more quickly, which is good if you haven't really been doing this a lot. But then you can also start working to make sources. And you can have someone I can just call on background and say, I don't really understand what's happening here. Why is this happening? Or what's going to happen next? What might happen next? And when you do that, you really build that foundation so that when you go somewhere bigger, all you're doing is just kind of scaling up a little bit at that point. But a smaller place where you get started as a young journalist, it's so, so valuable. I really hope, you know, similar to the conversation about AI, I really hope we don't get so far away from that.
AJ, before I let you go, this was asked at the panel. I'm going to paraphrase it, but I'll ask it to you again. What keeps you going in this industry despite all the challenges that we face every day as reporters and journalists?
I believe in it. I believe in journalism. I believe in the profession. I believe in the good it can do. I think that there's two ends of the spectrum where I think journalism can do a lot of good. It's holding the powerful people accountable. I think there will always be – I'd like to think there would always be a role for that in a civilized society. But then there's also the other side of it, which is you're able to amplify the stories of extraordinary people. And it's kind of that old, almost going back to ancient societies, the ability to use storytelling to inspire, to motivate, to keep things going. I think those two things, you know, holding the powerful accountable and really putting the most extraordinary among us on a platform and being able to say, look at this person who you might not have otherwise heard of if it wasn't for a radio broadcast or a TV story that gets spread on the web. And, you know, good for things like TikTok now and things like that, where anyone can do that. Anyone can find a good story. And if they're really good at presenting it and creating kind of a story arc that captures people's imaginations, you can really have something that spreads like wildfire. I love seeing that happen. I love seeing the reactions that people get when you tell a story about someone and they feel like you took care of their story. And now people are coming up to them and saying, oh my gosh, I saw your story. That's awesome. That keeps me going. And then also the people who say, you know, it doesn't happen often, but every now and then someone at a place like the grocery store might say something like, I'm glad you're holding MPS accountable, something to that effect. That's the fuel that keeps my fire burning.
CBS 58's AJ Biopour. Great stuff, AJ. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Adam. Happy to come on.